Welcome to the Industrial IoT Spotlight, your number one spot for insight from industrial IoT thought leaders who are transforming businesses today, with your host, Eric Walenza.
Welcome back to the Industrial IoT Spotlight podcast. I'm your host, Eric Walenza, CEO of IoT1, the consultancy that helps companies create value from data to accelerate growth. And our guest today is Nick Jordan, founder and CEO of Narrative. Narrative is a category-creating company that has redefined data commerce and helps organizations acquire and monetize data more efficiently. In this talk, we discussed data monetization from common use cases to marketplace pricing mechanisms to data quality assurance. We also explored how large, mature companies are monetizing data from devices and customer interactions in order to improve their margins. If you find these conversations valuable, please leave us a comment and a five-star review. And if you'd like to share your company's story or recommend a speaker, you can email us at team@iot1.com. Finally, if you have an IoT strategy, research, or training initiative that you would like to discuss, please email me directly at erik.walenza@iot1.com. Thank you. Nick, thanks for joining us on the podcast today.
Thanks for having me, Eric.
Great. Well, Nick, I always love talking to founders, and this is a particularly interesting business model focused on monetizing data. I think it's a topic everybody thinks about, and a lot of people are, including myself, are not quite sure how to do well, let's say, when you get into the details. So really looking forward to getting into that. But maybe before we get into the topic and your company, we can talk about you a little bit. And you've had a very successful career with Yahoo and Demdex and Adobe, and now you are a founder. And so it'd be interesting to understand what led you to leaving this successful, well-paid, stable, I suppose, career to jump into the unknown.
Yeah, what I've realized over the years is my real passion is solving problems. And I got to solve really interesting problems at all of those companies. But my last company was a company called TapAd before I founded Narrative. And I found a problem that we just had internally at the company. We were both a big buyer and a big seller of data. And that process was hopelessly broken. It was, maybe one of the most inefficient business processes I've ever experienced in my life. And being naive, I said to myself, well, certainly someone has solved this problem. I will find that person or that company, and then I will take their product and I will integrate it into my workflows. And the more I looked, the less I found anyone that had even come close to solving the problem. And so I found a problem. And again, I have a passion for solving problems. Step two was to say, do I have a solution for the problem, right? It could have been a problem that I also couldn't figure out. And so I gave myself about 6 months just to, noodle on the idea, whiteboard, run some things by trusted colleagues. And at the end of that 6 months, I basically decided that I thought I had a way to solve the problem that was both unique and effective. And so I started Narrative basically because I saw a problem that I couldn't unsee, and I thought that problem was important enough that it needed to be solved, and I couldn't live with myself if I didn't go try to solve it.
Sorry, this is a TapAd. That was sold, right? So did you leave after the acquisition, or what was the timeline there?
Yeah, maybe one of the most fortunate timing situations of my career. So, I originally had the idea for Narrative in the beginning of, I'm going to get the years wrong because so many years have gone by. Let's call it the beginning of 2015. And that's, I'd really given myself 6 months to convince myself that it was a good idea. I've got hundreds of ideas, and I'd say most of them are probably bad. And so an idea alone is not a good reason to go start a company. And so I had made the final decision in, say, October or November of that year that I was going to leave and start the company. I actually went to our CEO because I was on our management team. I said, hey, I really found something that I'm passionate about. I want to go start this company. I'm not going to give you 2 weeks notice. I'm telling you now, let's, spend, the next 2 or 3 months coming up with a transition plan. Maybe after the holidays, I won't come back to the company. Literally the next week, 6 days later, The CEO emailed me and he said, "Hey, there's some, you know, there's a management consulting team from Telenor, the Norwegian telecom, that's going to be in the office for, you know, 30 minutes next week. Would you sit in with me and just, you know, help them understand what we do?" And I don't know all of the details of how that meeting got set up and what the intentions were, but I suspect it wasn't, you know, it wasn't, "Hey, this company wants to acquire us," because it was a 30-minute meeting with, you know, someone that didn't even work at the company. It was someone they had to hire to sort of, you know, look at opportunities outside of Norway. And that meeting, which was scheduled for 30 minutes, lasted for 3.5 hours. And they asked us, "Hey, can you guys come to Norway next week to have a further discussion? Because we're interested in acquisition," or I think they probably referred to it as a strategic, you know, partnership or something like that. And so that deal went fairly quickly. You know, I'd say within 45 days, they had, you know, a term sheet where they were going to, you know, make an offer to buy the company. And there was another couple of months of due diligence before the deal closed. And so I stayed through all of that. But the day the deal closed, I basically was my last day employed by Tapad. And that's when I started Narrative. And so the fortunate part is I had the upside of being, you know, a senior leader in a company that exited for, you know, $400 million. So it was a fairly sizable exit. And it actually gave me a little bit of personal runway to go do the silly thing, which is start your own company and not pay yourself for a number of years without having to worry about how I was going to put food on the table.
Yeah. Wow. Okay. That's good timing. That's good timing. You know, I guess you get a little bit of luck and then you kind of earn that luck by putting yourself in the right place, but still timing's good. Interesting. And then you mentioned the problem here that you were struggling with buying and selling data and just being very frustrated. I think a lot of folks that are listening in on this are going to be in a position where maybe their organizations are involved in that, but they might not personally kind of understand the challenges. So what is the status quo situation look like if you're trying to buy and sell data?
It's funny because, you know, we're a venture backed company. So, you know, from the very earliest days through today, you know, we're out talking to the venture community and the investment community. And typically when I talk to people that don't know anything about buying and selling data, they say, "Well, you know, you cut someone a check and they, you know, ship you a thumb drive and that is how you buy and sell data." And I can say definitively that is not how data is bought and sold. You know, the first challenge is, you know, we talk about data as if it's a monolith, as if it's homogenous. Data comes literally in an infinite number of forms. And even data sets that represent similar things tend to come in different schemas and different formats and with different units of measure and all of these different things. And so oftentimes the early parts of buying and selling data are buyers and sellers finding each other. You know, then there's no, you know, historically there hasn't been a directory for people that want to buy or sell data. And so they kind of have to feel that out. And then there is a very long period where they are talking about what is the data that you have? How do you collect the data? You know, what happens in these scenarios with the data? And so there's this, you know, almost translation layer where the buyer thinks about data in a very specific way, the seller thinks about data in a very specific way, and they have to translate the way they think about data to something common to figure out if there's even a deal to be had. If there's a deal to be had, that's great. That's a check mark along the way. But then you get into, how do we build a commercial agreement around this? How do we concern ourselves with governance and regulations to the extent data is regulated in any way? What are the technical implications of how data gets from point A to point B? And then ultimately, how do we, you know, potentially rinse and repeat that process across additional partners, be it on the buy side or the sell side? So we usually tell people, if you're going to do a deal manually, just, "I'm a buyer and I want to buy data from a seller." If everything goes well, it's probably 6 months from start to finish, from the time you say, "Hey, I've got an initiative that requires me to buy data," to actually getting that data, you know, productionalized and the commercial agreement signed and starting to use that data. If everything goes well, it takes about 6 months.
Yeah, and it sounded very labor intensive and very expensive labor. So a lot of decision making, a lot of maybe lawyers and other specialists involved in this process. So a lot of overhead. So let's touch quickly on what data we're talking about, because I guess when we're talking about IoT, we could be talking about virtually anything from social media, kind of personally identifiable data, or kind of data that would be used for marketing, to data that you'd be used for R&D of new devices, or supply chain management. So are you here focused on particular types of data sets, or is this kind of a horizontal platform that could be potentially supporting transaction of any potential data set?
Yeah, it's a horizontal platform. In fact, we think of the underlying technology as basically being a database. We have a lot of the same constructs of a database. Companies can create tables, they can populate those tables with any arbitrary schema. We have query languages, we have ACLs or access rules that determines who can access what data and under what terms. And so it's very much a horizontal platform. I'd say the big area that we don't focus on today are, binary data blobs, right? We don't do things with satellite imagery or LIDAR or things that are producing, truly unstructured data. We can do things with that type of data, but we more focus on the metadata layer contained within those blobs versus us trying to figure out that a satellite image is a picture of a parking lot at a Walmart in upstate New York. Generally speaking, because data can be anything, we'd really be constraining ourselves if we said, hey, there's only one type of data that our platform will work with. Because I think over time, most people may start with a single type of data that they care about, but very quickly they want to start commingling and joining and expanding that to a much larger variety of data sets.
So where is the marketplace today? Is it still primarily buyer meets seller? They identify the opportunity for a transaction, and then instead of the manual process that used to exist, they would go on a platform like yours to kind of streamline the transaction? Or is it more of a marketplace where you can make a micro transaction and say, I'm going to buy a small bit of data for $300 or, and test it out, and then maybe I'll scale up and I can scale up and down like I'm using a cloud service. So where are we at today for, kind of transact, one-to-one transaction versus marketplace dynamics?
Yeah, it's very much the latter. We support the former, but, I think one of the big innovations we have in the platform is because we treat the software as a database. As a buyer, you can actually run a query. So let's say that you're looking for weather data, over a specific region that covers farmland that is owned by, an agriculture conglomerate. As the buyer of data, you can go in and say, I am looking for weather data that includes soil temperature, air temperature, precipitation rates, relative humidity, where that data was collected between June 1st, 2022 and September 1st, 2022, between the latitudes and longitudes of, XYXY. And assuming that the data is in the platform and the sellers on the platform are willing to sell that to you, our query engine, almost a SQL statement, will basically go record by record to make sure that every record in those data sets across multiple providers meets your criteria. And the transaction model in our marketplace is you're actually buying the data on a record by record basis. So no one technically buys a data set. They buy, a collection of thousands or millions or billions of records where the actual price is associated to each one of those records. So, we have, people say, well, how many transactions has your marketplace run? And I look at them and I say, somewhere around 9 trillion last year. The average transaction size was, a thousandth of a penny or something very, very tiny. But we have very much taken sort of that, microeconomic model of a marketplace. And again, no one's buying one record. They're still buying millions of records typically, but they can craft an execution that gets them the exact right million records that they want based on their criteria versus buying a data set that might have 30 million records in it, of which they're going to throw out 95% of it because it's not germane to the problem they're trying to solve.
Okay, great. Yeah, this is super interesting. I think we have to approach it from a few different perspectives. So let's kind of take them one at a time And then I'm probably going to miss some things and you'll have to help me fill in some gaps at the end. But maybe we can start with the less technical bits here. So if we look at the use cases, I guess, you know, marketing data is probably the thing that first comes to mind with people, but I guess there's going to be a really long tail of use cases. And then there's probably a short list of more common use cases. So what would be, you know, maybe we can cover the more common ones and maybe some of the more interesting long tail use cases that you've seen users of the platform adopt.
Sure. So, I mean, there are certainly marketing use cases. We work with a number of customers that have relationships with their customers. You know, they have a CRM, but they know a very limited amount about their customers, right? So you can imagine if you sell beverages, you know, if you sell cola to customers, first, there's probably a number of people that you don't have a direct relationship with because, you know, people don't go to Coca-Cola and Pepsi directly to buy drinks. They go to grocery stores and bodegas and Amazon to buy drinks. But that, you know, they may have, you know, events that they run where they're actually able to collect information around, you know, the people that drink their beverage of choice. But even in those examples, they know very little about their customers. You know, they may know their email address. You know, they may know that they signed up, you know, for a promotion around a particular product. But beyond that, you know, they have a very limited understanding of who their customers are. And so a use case that they execute against the platform is to basically enrich their CRM with additional information about their customers so they can create, you know, better cohorts or better understanding of who is buying and consuming their products. And so our platform allows them to push their existing CRM into our system and say, I would like to buy additional information about these users, you know, and I may specifically want to buy, you know, their household income, or if they prefer to shop at, you know, Kroger or Piggly Wiggly. And so, you know, going back to that concept of a microtransaction is they're only buying data on users that are already in their system, which is important from an efficiency play. And then they can choose which data they want to buy about those users to fill in the additional information in their CRM so their marketing teams or their sales teams can go execute against their newly found knowledge.
Okay, and so that one makes intuitive sense. I think a lot of businesses have acquired some kind of data set around that use case. You know, our podcast is, you know, obviously kind of heavily oriented on IoT, and I think there's a lot of interesting areas to explore there, but also a lot more complexity when it comes to kind of acquiring IoT data, you know, transportation data, weather data, sensor data, whatever that might be. Are you already transacting kind of IoT data today? What is the potential there that you see for that marketplace?
Yeah, we are, and we see a huge potential. So, you know, we work with a fairly large customer that has weather sensors all around the U.S. They're, you know, I think their traditional business model is helping farmers understand when frost is going to occur and help them take precautions to make sure that frost doesn't impact their crop yield. But they do that by putting sensors, you know, in fields all around the U.S. And those sensors collect, you know, all of the traditional, you know, weather-related information that we would expect as consumers, and then a bunch of things that are very specific to agriculture, pH levels and nitrogen levels, and, you know, things that, frankly, I don't understand all of that well. Historically, the company has collected all of this data, and then they basically, you know, they provide predictions or reports to farmers or agricultural conglomerates that help them run their business. But by virtue of collecting all of this data from these sensors, they've actually opened up a number of other data monetization opportunities. You know, they may want to sell some of that data to governmental organizations that are trying to better, you know, understand how climate change is impacting, you know, at the ground level, certain conditions that are related to agriculture. There may be financial services institutions that want to understand how, you know, the changing climate and you know, modalities that are being collected might impact crop yield from a financial perspective, from a commodities perspective. And so they've already collected the data. The data is already being collected. What we allow them to do is pipe all of that data into our platform and then allow a fairly non-technical user to package that data into data sets that can be sold to financial institutions and governmental institutions and NGOs and really anyone else that's looking for that data that will help them solve a problem.
Since you mentioned it, maybe we can get into the users here. So yeah, I mean, this is an area where there's obviously a lot of technology involved, but you mentioned that it's possible for users that are not particularly technical to use the platform. So what does it look like if I, you know, I go on the platform and I'm trying to find a particular data set? I have to make sure that the metadata also kind of matches my requirements, but I might be a little bit vague on you know, what that actually entails. What would be the user journey for a non-technical individual?
Yeah, I mean, we basically have a data catalog. So, you know, you can open up a page and see hundreds of different types of data that are available on the platform. And when I say types of data, I don't mean data sets, really. I mean fields that exist in data sets. And so one of the things in that data catalog might be air quality. And so, you know, particulate matter per, you know, million parts. One of them might be air temperature. One might be soil temperature. One might be the, you know, collection timestamp. So when a particular reading was collected. And so each of these things, you know, lives in a list. And usually the first thing that people do is they define what they're looking for. And so if you're an analyst, or even if you're a business development person that's working with an analyst and you say, you know, I need a data set where I can correlate particulate matter, you know, air quality with and soil temperature with crop yield. And I already have a data set that shows me crop yields. You know, I now just need to buy a data set that has the air quality, that has the soil temperature, that has the time of when those measurements happened, and maybe the location, the latitude and longitude of those measurements. If I could get that data set and I could combine it with the data set that I already have, I can now go produce a report that shows the correlation between air quality, soil temperature, and crop yields. And so they go into that data catalog, they find the four pieces of information that they need that they don't already have. And we can basically say, yes, we have one or more providers on the platform that can make that data available to you. If you tell us more specifically, you know, which states, which latitudes and longitudes you want that data from, we can actually give you a forecast of how much of that data is available and how much it would cost. And then even beyond that, you know, if you like the cost and how much data is available based on the settings that you've put in, you can click a button and put in your credit card and buy that data and have that data, you know, available on your hard drive within 15 or 20 minutes.
And the cost structure here, is it the seller? Is it like you have a range, like a recommended range, but then the seller would decide how much they want to price their data? Or how do you align on pricing for the data sets?
Yeah, Narrative as an entity doesn't buy data and we don't sell data, right? We provide the software and the pipes that allow the buying and selling to happen. And so we are very dogmatic that both the buyer and seller should be able to set their own business rules when working within this platform. And so from a seller's perspective, they can set whatever price that they want, and they can set price based on the number of records that are purchased. They could have a flat fee for their data. They can give their data away for free if they want to give their data away for free. They also have controls on who can buy their data. You know, we talk about it as if it's a fully public marketplace, and many data providers do make their data fully publicly available, but some will actually constrain to say, hey, I'll sell this data, but I don't want to sell it to my competitor, or I'll sell this data, but I don't want to sell it to someone in an industry maybe where I don't have the contractual rights to sell the data to. And so our customers aren't losing any control over how they price or how they monetize or who they sell their data to. And then on the buy side, you can also say, you know, I'm willing to pay a particular price. And if you're willing to pay a price that isn't congruent with the price that the seller is looking to get, then you can't buy their data without going into a process within the platform where you can actually say to the seller, hey, I'd really like your data. You know, I work as an academic researcher at Iowa State University. And so I don't have a huge budget to buy your, you know, climate IoT data, but, you know, I'd really like to use this data to write a paper. You know, is there any chance that you would sell it to me for cheaper or give it to me for free based on my use case? And so you can actually have those conversations within the platform because, you know, while we'd like to automate everything, you know, we understand that oftentimes in business there are negotiations. I think our goal is to keep those negotiations in the platform as much as possible and have them happen as quickly as possible so we don't end up in a situation like we were previous to narrative where those conversations might take months and require 10, 15, 20 meetings to get done.
And then your business model, would it be charging a fraction of a cent on, you know, every piece of data that's moved, or how does that work?
Yeah, we have two lines of revenue. So, you know, where we are the facilitator of the transaction, we will take a small percentage of that transaction. We actually take the percentage on both the buy side and sell side. So, you know, someone buys $100 worth of data, you know, we invoice them for $110. We pay $90 to the seller. We do that because we don't see ourselves as a fiduciary for the buyer or the seller, you know, separately. We see ourselves as a fiduciary for, you know, for both sides. And we really want to be agnostic from an incentive perspective. And then we also license the software itself. So just like Snowflake licenses their database technology, and you pay for Snowflake based on the amount of data that you store and the queries that you run and how much processing happens. You know, a lot of our value add is, you know, we take these really complex transactions and automate them. And, you know, the size and the complexity of those transactions largely backs into what our cost basis is. And so we will also charge just for use of the platform because we're providing compute and transfer and storage for all of our customers.
Gotcha. Okay. And then there's the question of verification, I guess. I mean, I get probably one email a day or so of somebody selling me some data set about an event that they scraped, and I'm sure that you're able to filter that out. But still, there could be issues here regarding ownership of data. Does somebody really have the right to sell the data? Around accuracy, is this data quality? Somebody could be using an algorithm to just kind of auto-generate data sets and make them look like they were valid. What's the process to guarantee ownership and accuracy?
Yeah, so there's a number of different protections in place. First and foremost, the platform is entirely transparent. When a buyer buys data from a seller, the buyer knows who the seller is, the seller knows who the buyer is. And so if there are any concerns or if, you know, there's a level of diligence that either side wants to do on the other, they are free to do that either inside or outside of the platform. And so, you know, as I like to say, you know, sunlight is the best disinfectant. And to the extent that, you know, no one's hiding their identity on the platform, it allows for, you know, each company to make their own decisions in terms of, you know, risk and reward, in terms of governance and quality and all of the rest. The second thing is, we have some apps that sit on top of our pipes that can actually do things like score the validity of data sets. Those are typically done in two different ways. One might be for a buyer to upload data that they believe is already very high quality, and we can actually compare the buyer's data with the seller's data within the platform, so without either the buyer or the seller seeing each other's data, and, you know, basically create a confusion matrix that says, hey, where you think X thing is true, you know, 98% of the time, the supplier also thinks X thing is true. Where you think X thing is false, you know, the supplier, you know, only thinks that thing is false 65% of the time. And so you can sort of create some metrics around, if you have a data set that you strongly believe in, you know, how in line, how, you know, how accurate, what is the precision of that data set when compared to the supplier's data set? And at that point, you know, the buyer can make a decision based on whatever, you know, they consider a good score across those. And then we also have third-party data providers that, you know, whose entire business is doing data validation. And they make their data available on the platform for a fee. And so if a buyer wanted to score some data where maybe they didn't have any ground truth, they could basically license that you know, trusted third party's data to do that same process of scoring the supplier and you know, figuring out if it was you know, effective for whatever their given use case might be.
Yeah, well, let's talk a bit about the use cases then. And maybe we can, before we get into specific cases, we can talk more generally about the users here. I mean, it's already, you know, it's a horizontal platform, so I'm sure there's a very fragmented set of users. But what are the, you know, if we look at industry, if we look at organization type, are we talking about tech companies? Are we talking about research organizations? Are we talking about marketing teams at large, you know, consumer products companies? Who would be the most common set of users today?
I'll give you the same answer that I give my investors, and they don't love the answer either. So I don't know if you will, but it's kind of all of the above. You know, we work with some very big CPGs, both within their research and their marketing arms, to access data. We work with some research groups, with a couple of different polling and survey related firms. You know, on the polling side, you know, every question a pollster asks you, you're more likely to stop responding to the pollster. And so they're really focused on getting the answers to the most important questions they want to ask, but then they, you know, they want to add additional answers, but in a way that is passive to the, you know, the person. So they enrich their data sets with additional things. You know, within technology organizations, it's often product management teams or data science or data engineering, or data analytics teams. You know, data has become so pervasive through almost every organization, that we see, you know, almost every team and every vertical at every size of company is a potential customer. I will say that our focus has been more on, you know, medium to large enterprises than it has been, you know, to the, you know, small business and in mid market. But we do have some, you know, 2 and 3 person startups or, you know, companies that maybe have 80 or 90 people that have a very specific data need. You know, most recently we've started working with a lot of retailers as retailers look to figure out how they can use their data to augment their retail business. So it really is broad based, and you know, I contend my investors should be very happy about that. You know, I think the challenge becomes is, you know, as a, you know, we're a 40 person company, trying to service everyone is a little bit of a fool's errand, and so we need to show a little bit of focus. But the software was built in such a way that almost anyone can use it, and as a CEO, as a founder, I have trouble saying, I have software that could help you solve a problem, but because you're not the specific focus of my company, I'm not going to let you go use it to solve your problem.
Yeah. And to some extent, I mean, you have to learn also as a company, who are the, you know, where is the value? And that requires experimentation by your customers as well. What about on the other side of the marketplace? Yeah, you've mentioned a couple types of contributors of data from the sell side. But is it mostly people that, you know, they're running a business and they have a data set and they say, well, we can earn an extra 3% on our, you know, profit margin if we monetize this data, and it doesn't cost very much, so let's do it? Or are there companies that are building businesses specifically around monetizing data, and that's kind of a primary revenue stream for them? How does that marketplace, the sell side, look like?
It's both. I mean, there certainly are companies that is their primary model. Like, they sell data and we give them a easier, faster, better way for them to sell data. And that happens where companies that have been selling data for 20 years, and we just give them a piece of technology that makes their lives easier. And we also talk to companies that that's their primary business and they've been doing it for 6 weeks and they're really nowhere. Arguably, the ones that have been doing it for 6 weeks are a little bit easier to work with because they don't have any sunk cost in the systems they may have built themselves. Like, they're just trying to get off the ground. And, you know, we very much look like Salesforce for data monetization to them, right? Like, you know, no company in 2022 builds their own CRM. 30 years ago, 40 years ago, that wasn't true. You might build your own CRM because it, you know, it was really hard to get something turnkey that did what you want it to. But we see both there. And then, you know, what I find most interesting is we're seeing more and more companies And I think this is especially true with IoT, or really anyone that builds hardware, is that hardware historically is a very low margin business. You know, if you go buy a 75 inch, you know, ultra high def television on Amazon, you can basically buy it for $700, I think, today. It may cost the television manufacturer $650 if you include their marketing and their distribution to actually sell that TV. The retailer is taking another, 30 or 40% of the profit margin. So you sell a $750 TV, you may keep 45, maybe less in profit. And so over the lifetime of that TV, which may be 5 to 10 years, if you can also find ways to take data from that TV and monetize it, almost act like a Nielsen for folks that are trying to understand, what people are watching on their TV, you may be able to earn another $50 to $100 for that same TV. And so on a top line basis, the revenue may seem like hey, it's 5% or 10% of our gross revenue. But when you actually look at the profitability of those things, you can sell a lot of $750 TVs, but the profit remains fairly low. The profit margin on data is very, very high. And so even if it doesn't make up a huge chunk of gross revenue, it can make up a much larger chunk of your profit margin.
Yeah, makes sense. I mean, there's been a lot of talk in the automotive industry about this. Again, another industry with a lot of data, very high revenue, very low margins. In some interesting cases,
I think you're seeing that a ton in retail right now. Like, I don't fully grok the grocery store margins, but my guess is they're pretty thin. And I guess places like Amazon selling groceries make their margins even thinner. And so they certainly are looking ways to augment revenue. And if you have a family that, does all of their grocery shopping at one grocery chain, that's very rich data about how those people behave. And it can be monetized for all of those CPG brands. It can be monetized in any number of ways. And I think almost ironically, the Amazons of the world are leading in sort of the retail data monetization space, because arguably they're the ones that need to do that least. They also happen to be the most technically savvy. But you're starting to see almost all of the other retailers, not just in grocery, but in other areas, start to say, hey, I'm sitting on a gold mine worth of data, and my traditional business runs at very low margins. We need to figure this out sooner rather than later.
In cases like this, you're dealing with PII data. Is it kind of up to the seller to ensure that they're complying with all, if they're dealing with Europe and GDPR and so forth, that they're in compliance, or do you have that built into the platform?
A little bit of both. So it certainly is up to them to make sure that they're complying. In GDPR terms, we are a processor, not a controller. That being said, we give our customers a bunch of tools to make that compliance easier. So tools around right to be forgotten requests, us actually passing those right to be forgotten requests downstream to anyone else that may have access to that data, getting acknowledgments from the downstream providers that they received the right to be forgotten request, receiving another acknowledgment when they've actually deleted the data, propagating that acknowledgment back to the originator of the data, and basically keeping a paper trail of the entire thing. And so we tell people that we're not a silver bullet, and you no longer have to worry about GDPR or CCPA or any of the other four-letter acronyms that go along with this stuff. And frankly, if anyone tells you they're a silver bullet, run as fast as you can, because they're not. But our goal is to lessen the administrative burden by giving folks a bunch of tools that let them be compliant, be confident in their compliance, while still keeping an eye to what the regulatory frameworks are asking them to do.
Let's talk about the future of it. You've mentioned already that you're venture backed. I imagine that you always have a certain amount of pressure from your investors to look towards the future and kind of carve out that vision. If you look, medium term, 24 months, what's on the horizon for your product roadmap, or new markets that you want to enter into? And then maybe if there are topics, longer term, 5-10 years down the road, of things that you're particularly, excited about in terms of potential developments, would love to hear those as well.
Yeah. So, we're at a, somewhat of an interesting point for us. You know, early on in any startup's, you know, life cycle, there tends to be a lot of innovation, right? You're making a lot of step function improvements or changes in the product. That certainly was true for us over the, you know, first 3 or 4 years of the product. We've really hit a place where the product is very strong. There are, and I tell people, not facetiously, although I think they assume it is, that I've got a 100-year roadmap in my head. And so, you know, there is a lot of work to be done. A lot of that work is now making incremental improvements of different modules and different components within the platform. A lot of the core functionality is actually there. You know, the thing that we rolled out earlier this year that we continue to improve on is, I like to refer to it as machine learning. You know, the marketer in me would refer to it as artificial intelligence. But basically, as data comes into the platform, our system is able to classify the data and also infer any transformations that may need to be made to that data to eliminate the normalization problem that we typically see in data marketplaces. So I've talked about weather data, right? You know, air temperature could be in Celsius, it could be in Fahrenheit, it could be in Kelvin. We've actually seen with geolocation data that everyone assumes that latitude and longitude is using the standard latitude and longitude that's used, you know, by, you know, consumer mapping applications. But oftentimes they use these different earth projections that are based on standards released by the oil industry. So you can't just take a latitude and longitude and assume it's going to be the same across all data sets. And so this artificial intelligence is basically acting as the normalization and the standardization layer in the middle, which just removes the need for both buyers and sellers to have to try to figure out how each other talks about the data or is going to consume the data. We call the technology Rosetta Stone because we think it acts as that universal translation layer. Certainly we'll be, you know, adding and improving to that over time. And I think to your question about verticals or use cases, you know, our product today is, you know, in some ways generalized, right? You could go in and use it for agricultural use cases. You could go in and use it for marketing. You could go in and use it for financial services use cases. But you basically get the same interface across all of those. One of the things that we're really focused on is either building applications on top of our products or our platform ourselves that are much more use case or solution specific. So taking the same functionality, but just creating a better user experience around it. And also opening up via a developer SDK to allow other companies and other developers to add on to the platform. You know, I started out this by saying that data, you know, comes in an infinite number of forms. And that's one of the reasons that you know, data marketplaces are very challenging. The other challenging part is people want to do an infinite number of things with the data once they get it. And our focus as a company is not really, you know, giving people answers from the data. It's getting them the data. But oftentimes people want answers or they want, you know, visualizations or they want predictions to come from the data. And so allowing other developers to extend our platform to take the data and the data liquidity that's available there and actually build applications that go into that much more, you know, specific realm of giving someone an answer, but doing it natively within our platform will be a big part of our growth over the next couple of years.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, I mean, I could imagine a use case like Tableau or something, right, where you're kind of doing your analysis and you say, well, I would like to have that data set and just, you know, kind of plug in. Do you have any partnerships or anything on the horizon where people would be able to kind of embed your data sets in an existing functionality? And then maybe that's what you're referring to here.
Yeah. So it's actually, there's a press release that's going out literally as we talk right now about, you know, allowing people to take data from our platform and embed it into a marketing platform called the Trade Desk. And so that's an instance where we're actually taking the data and pushing it downstream on someone's behalf, but doing it in a very native way. And then you asked a question about data quality. You know, our first externally developed application on our platform was from a company called Truthset. And Truthset's business is they have data that is scored across a number of different criteria. And they built an application on our platform that allows you to take their data scoring methodology and apply it to data that you already own. So, you know, is this data that I have any good? Or apply it to data that you may be considering buying? And so that's not actually something we do natively. And in fact, in some ways, you know, us wanting to be agnostic, I don't know if we really want to be the ones that say this data is good or this data is bad. But they built an application on top of our platform where, you know, with, you know, four clicks of a mouse, you can basically score the data. So you can make a better decision as to if you actually want to buy it or not.
Okay. Yeah. Very interesting. Well, I think you got a great business. You're certainly, timed it well. I can imagine. I mean, this market's just going to explode in the coming decades. Anything that we didn't touch on, Nick, that you think is important for folks to understand?
No, I think we talked about a lot of it. I guess something that I don't say often enough is the platform is fully self-service. You know, if anyone wanted to go play with it and see how it works, they can go to app.narrative.io. They can sign up for an account and they can start, you know, using it, you know, without talking to our amazing enterprise sales team. They can get an idea of how the technology actually works. You know, our real goal is to take things that traditionally are really hard or really painful for our customers and make them easy. We think we've certainly, you know, taken a lot of good first steps in that direction, but we're always happy to hear feedback and things that we could do better or places that we may be failing that mission. So we would love to hear feedback from any of your listeners.
Awesome. Nick, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for tuning in to another edition of the Industrial IoT Spotlight. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at IoT1HQ and to check out our database of case studies on IoT1.com. If you have unique insight or a project deployment story to share, we'd love to feature you on a future edition. Write us at eric.walenza@iot1.com.